journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning, wherever you are on this beautiful green planet spinning in the depths of space. Let's hope this time I've got everything sorted out. I've moved into my new house, this is my new studio, and I've actually got a real live human guest in the studio itself today. I have interviewed him before. We've been talking about John Dee. We've been talking about the Cathars. So tonight we're going to kind of bring all of those elements in, plus a few new things that he's been doing. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the new Studio 9 here in Murrayshire, north of Scotland, Mr. Dave Patrick. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Thanks.
So, lovely to have you here. we're a bit shivery at the moment because... We've only come in about an hour ago, and the stove has not quite heated up. I'm looking at this flame licking away at the bottom of the log, but it's not really kicking out too much of that good old home fire heat yet. So let's hope that our voices won't be too tremulous as we go through the hour. So welcome, Dave. Welcome back to Journeys.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be back. And this is about fourth time, or
it's about
between the two shows.
Yeah, between the two shows. Yeah. But you've definitely been on the Journeys before.
I've certainly been on a journey. That's for sure.
So let's start on your journey. We last spoke, and you just released three books, or you released the third in a series.
Yeah.
So do you want to, first of all, bring people up to speed with what those three books are about? And then maybe we can talk about why the three books, why they link together, what's the common threads that now in the 2020 of hindsight you can see?
Well, the first book was, on Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and he was somebody who had been a great inspiration to me for a number of years. I really started to get into his life and work round about 2003, 2004, actually before I moved up to Highlands of Scotland. And I was just so amazed by what he managed to achieve in his lifetime, because he's generally known as the, creator of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And it's quite interesting that Sherlock Holmes is becoming more and more into sort of public consciousness now with the two big movies, with Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law. And also Sherlock on the BBC TV with Benedict Cumberbatch. What a name, eh?
Wow.
But he plays Sherlock, and that's a kind of modern day. I don't know if you've seen that at all.
No, I don't watch TV.
You've heard of it?
No.
All right, okay.
So Conan Doyle's been big in the news, really.
Yeah, but I mean, what got me interested was more his spiritual background rather than his Sherlock Holmes. Because as people out there may or may not know, he was an ardent spiritualist in his lifetime.
Yeah.
But having said that, that was only really the latter 12 or 13 years of his life. He died in 1930, and it was just before the end of the First World War that he kind of came out and said, became an advocate for spiritualism and the afterlife and the psychic question, as he called it. But, there's been a lot of misinformation and disinformation in the media about that aspect of his life, because the conventional wisdom was that he'd lost his son and he'd lost his brother in the First World War, and of course the implication there is they were killed in action, but actually they weren't. Both of them died in the Spanish flu epidemic at the end of the war.
Right.
Kingsley, his son, had been injured but not fatally. He'd been wounded in action, but as I said, he was convalescing, and But when you look at the evidence which I researched, he'd actually come out about spiritualism in 1916, you know, 2 years before both his family members had died. And he'd been a skeptic himself right back to the 1880s when the Society for Psychical Research had started up in 1882. I think Conan Doyle got involved with that about 1886. But he very, very much was very skeptical. Because again, you've got to remember that he was a trained doctor. So he had a very sharp scientific mind.
Mm.
But he was willing to study it. And he worked with mediums and he got involved with seances. But from a scientific point of view, you know, he just didn't believe everything.
Yeah.
And he was working with people like Sir Oliver Lodge, William Crookes, you know, eminent scientists of the day. And it took him 30 years to kind of get over that skepticism. But he eventually said, no, the scientific proof is all there. So he devoted the rest of his life to getting the message out.
Mm.
And the book that kind of inspired me was one of his called The Vital Message. He had two books, came out in 1918, 1919. First one was A New Revelation, second one was called The Vital Message. And I actually based my first book on that theme, because Conan Doyle's 150th anniversary of his birth was coming up in 2009.
That's right.
22nd of May, and I knew, although I felt inspired to do something to honour that, I didn't have time to write a whole book on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had this idea, or I was guided to give, you know, get this mm-hmm. idea to get contributors to the book. So I went out into my network and wider network, and it just became an amazing journey. I ended up with 29 contributors.
Mm. And some of them are quite luminary, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't about that. I mean, obviously it helps to sell books if you've got people
name,
who are, got a name, but I mean, but it was everything from, you know, well-known authors who have published millions to people who had never written anything or had anything published. And that was a great joy of it. It was a complete span. And there was no planning. It just kind of unfolded into like six sections,
mm-hmm.
which is quite amazing. But, I mean, the names that people would probably recognize, obviously Neil Donald Walsh, who had written the Conversations with God series.
Oh, yeah. Great.
And so he, you know, he came on board through a whole series of synchronicities that, you know, allowed me to contact him. Peter Russell, who had been a friend of mine for quite a number of years, probably about 20 years beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter had been involved with the Maharishi and written the TM handbook. And his thing was about uniting spirituality and science. He's a first class honours, I think, from Cambridge or Oxford. I think it was Cambridge. I'm not 100% sure on that. But, you know, so that was his kind of life kind of mission to marry these two things together. And he published a lot of books on that. He's also a fellow of the Findhorn Foundation as well.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Findhorn, Dorothy McLean was a contributor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was quite interesting how I met her. How that all came about. And I suppose the other kind of big name, if you like, was Irvin Laszlo, whom I was lucky enough to meet actually at Findhorn at a conference, introduced by Peter Russell. But I already knew Irvin's son, Alexander, who's lives in California. I'd met him out in California mm-hmm. in 2004. So again, all these kind of links and strands and things were good.
So synchronicities. Random.
Well, not random.
Random meetings. Well, I mean, in
it
terms
seems
of,
like that. Yeah.
Yeah, they seem random at the time, except when you look back,
yeah.
It all fits into a picture, yeah. which you're probably a little more aware of now than you were a few years ago, as to, ooh, I've got something to do in this life. This is, you know, there's a direction, there's a mission in life.
Absolutely. Cause I mean, before I did the first book, I mean, I must admit I was getting a bit rudderless and, I'd moved north from Aberdeenshire in Scotland to the Highlands. I mean, there's a whole series of reasons for that. But I was really looking for some kind of new direction and things just seemed to pop up. I mean, the spiritualism aspect, I mean, I'd come from a Church of Scotland background, but ended up getting involved with a spiritualist church, which, you know, locally, which I didn't expect. But I realised that was part of my kind of link to Conan Doyle and the spiritualist side of his development, you know, in his physical life. But then, as I write about in the first book, the big breakthrough was somebody gave me a copy of the book Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook, and that's when the link was made with the White Eagle Lodge, mm-hmm. and Conan Doyle had channeled, you know, back in the early 1930s, after he died, through Grace Cook, who was a spiritualist medium at the time, talking about the afterlife, actually from the other side,
all right.
which is interesting. And he, basically the message there was that although he was on the right track during his physical life, it was incomplete, and now he was saying, as it actually was, as he was experiencing it. But he said the big message was that you don't have to wait till you die to go to, quotes, heaven or, quotes, hell. Mm-hmm. It's a question of your spiritual development in this physical lifetime. It's important. We have the possibility to actually bring heaven onto earth in this lifetime. And not only that, but it's our thinking during this lifetime that determines what we experience and create in the afterlife. Our thinking more than even our actions, which is interesting. So, you know, people say, you know, be careful what you think about. I mean, that's very true.
Yeah.
Especially if you get into a negative spin, because you can end up, you know, if you're not careful, you could pass on and you find, oh, God, you've got the same issues to go through.
As far as I'm concerned, that's like, where karma comes from.
Exactly.
By acting inappropriately or, unskillfully. Oops. Well, okay. Well, you're going to have to talk for a little bit while I go and get a towel.
tell the audience about the connection with Cook and the spiritualists.
Yeah. Apologies. While I was talking, I just knocked over a cup of tea, which is on the small table here. So Jeremy's just going to get a cloth. So I'll take you into a bit of my story, and apologies if any of you have heard it before, but what happened was I decided to, as I said, write this first book to honour Conan Doyle's 150th anniversary, and one of the people I had in mind to write a chapter was a guy called Colm Hayward, who was the grandson of Grace and Ivan Cook. Now, he'd written an update on this book that I mentioned. Ivan Cook's book was The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle, which was published, I think, in 1956. And Colm had written an update in the 1990s. And anyway, to cut a long story short on that one, I found out that Colm not only was happy to contribute a chapter to the book, but he also ran a publishing business based in London, and he was willing to publish the book for me. And he was able to bring in some other contributors too. So I ended up with 29 contributors. Colm, he's a grandson of Grace and Ivan Cook. He was a minister in the White Eagle Lodge itself, which had been set up in 1936. And Conan Doyle, well, channeling through Grace Cook, played a major part in the setup of the White Eagle Lodge. And before I'd actually met Colm, it was at a White Eagle Lodge retreat. I'd actually joined the White Eagle Lodge myself. So again, it was all part of my kind of journey. So that was Conan Doyle. He's remained an amazing influence in my life as, you know, part of my kind of unfolding journey. But as Jeremy said at the start of the programme, why three books? Well, Colm and I, when we started collaborating on the first book, we kind of had a sense that it was going to be at least three books in the series anyway. So after the first book was published, and the first book's called The View, From Conan Doyle to Conversations with God, Neil Donald Walsh, as I said, was a contributor, and he gave us permission to use Conversations with God in the subtitle to the book. So The View is available on Amazon. It's not quite out of print, I don't think, but if you have a check, it's called The View. If you put in my name as well, Dave Patrick, and should be there if you're interested. Moving on, February 2010, Colm then asked me to contribute, or I had an idea for a follow-up book, and I said, great, and I said, who's this going to be on? And he said, Sir Francis Bacon. And not the artist, this is the Elizabethan, as I found out. Now, just to explain, I had not actually heard of Sir Francis Bacon at the time. I'd been brought up in the Scottish educational system, and we hadn't actually covered Bacon, or certainly not that I remembered. And
well, I said, you knew, came with eggs.
Yes. So I
there's your tea again.
Thank you. And I'll try not to knock this one over. I'll try to put a body up. Yeah.
It's on a slightly, it's a slightly weirdly balanced stool, but it shouldn't have fallen over.
No, I knocked it with my hand. I think I was trying to explain something.
Oh, I see.
You know how you use your hands on radio.
Yeah, I know. I remember the last interview we had, you kept on hitting the microphone.
That's right, So that was it. So bacon, so I decided that I would...
You can lean back.
I can lean back. Yeah, right, okay. So bacon, I was happy to do it. So of course it was going way up the learning curve for me to find out about his life and the many facets of it. You know, was he the illegitimate son of Queen Elizabeth I and Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester? Was he the true author of the Shakespeare plays and sonnets? Was he at an esoteric level, part of the lineage of including Saint-Germain and Christopher Columbus and Masterard and possibly even Carl Jung more recently? So a very, you know, a number of aspects to it.
And that's where I, you know, that's where I kind of, you and I kind of connected at that point.
Yeah.
Because at that time I was, investigating alongside, Tracy Kennedy. We were looking at the character John Dee.
Yep.
And then you said, oh, yeah, John Dee, he's connected with Francis Bacon, and I'm looking at Francis Bacon. So I asked you how to have a look at John Dee as well, and you found that there were these interesting personal interactions between the two of them.
Well, John Dee was quite a bit older than Francis Bacon. Mm-hmm. I think he was about 40 or 50 years older, but he was very much a mentor, I think, certainly during part of Bacon's life. Mm. He was also the court astrologer to Elizabeth I. I'm no great expert in Dee. I did go to, I think I maybe mentioned before, I went to a John Dee symposium in Clun in Shropshire, and that was in the summer of last year. And that was very interesting. Mm-hmm. Looking at various aspects of Dee's life. But just going back to, okay, what connected, Francis Bacon with, Conan Doyle? So, interestingly, again, February 2010, at that point, yet when the book was published, and that's called The View Beyond, that was the 450th anniversary of Bacon's birth. Invited to speak at the Francis Bacon Society, if you remember.
Mm.
And, actually, I couldn't have done
that. So you didn't do too badly, yeah.
Didn't do too badly. Was in December last year, after our last interview.
Last show,
so
yeah,
I can kind of update a bit on that when I introduce the third
side of it. Because this is where you've been drawing those threads together with other threads now with the third book, which is connected with the Cathars.
That's right.
So, how do we go from, how do you get from Conan Doyle to the Cathars in three easy steps, you know?
Well, in fact, funnily enough, it does seem quite easy in retrospect. I mean, but only easy because we've just had such a magical collection of contributors to the books. Because we've had, 25 people plus or minus for each of the three. And it's just been the most amazing experience. The Cathars, well, interestingly, the three books actually take us back further back in time each time, because you're going back 150 years to Conan Doyle, 450 years to Bacon, and then you're going back 700 years plus to the Cathars, because I think, as I said in the last program where you interviewed me, the Cathars were around predominantly in the 12th, 13th centuries, and predominantly around the Languedoc area of southwest France, but they're treated as heretics by the Catholic Church, and ruthlessly exterminated by the Catholic Inquisition. And that all culminated largely at Montségur on the 16th of March 1244, the big siege there, and they capitulated and over 200 of them came down the hill and apparently, walked onto the burning pyres, and quite willingly, rather than recant their faith. Now, the Cathars, what made them different was that they believed in two gods, the good god and the evil god.
Yeah.
The good god was the spiritual god. So it was like the non-physical stuff. That was the important bit for them. Mm-hmm. And the evil God was all to do with greed and materialism and the physical life and what have you. And exactly the kind of issues that we're facing nowadays.
Right, yeah.
And interestingly, you know, Bacon himself had rallied against materialism in his day, in Elizabethan times. And it's quite interesting, again, you know, when you look at these characters, how we end up with this kind of conventional wisdom. Yeah. But when you start to research, you find that actually it's not as...
Very wise,
this, no. And with Bacon, well, he was the one that came up with the quote, "Knowledge is power," which everybody's heard of. But he's also the one who's been acknowledged as the founder of the scientific method. Although he was not a scientist himself, he'd come in up with this very structured method, which he included in his book, The Great Instauration, which it's called, and sort of six levels, and just amazing mind he had. But from what I can see is that the scientific method as we have nowadays is incomplete compared to what Bacon was talking about. Because the big bit that's missing is the spiritual element and also the connection with nature and the connection with health and healing. It's all been kind of taken over by the corporates, the pharmaceutical companies, the food companies, and it's all been driven by greed and profit and money, rather than the holistic basis of science that could actually help us to evolve forward.
Yeah. Where it's not about healing, truly, it's really about keeping people ill.
Well, exactly.
And making money from them.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had a lot, he's got a lot to answer for. Well, not really him, because his movement has been hijacked by the powers like everything else.
Well, that's right. But, and it's interesting, again, you know, when you look at the Cathars, you're going back 700 years, and yet there's been this tremendous resurgence, especially over the last 70 years, but it's been increasing over, you know, the last few years. Things like the Da Vinci Code has had a great impact on that, because that kind of overlaps on the Cathar era and the story there, and the Holy Blood, Holy Grail story with, you know, Ren Le Chateau and Sonia the priest and all the wealth, and where did all that come from? So you've got all these different strands, but as I said in the Cathar book, and a group of us went from the White Eagle Lodge across the Languedoc last year, and again, some amazing synchronicities which I write about in the book, led us into the Cathar caves where we met the most incredible people. We're actually going back to Ren Le Chateau in May this year. I think we're doing a book launch over there. So if anybody's in that region that is listening in, you're welcome to come to...
Well, fancy's coming along to the book launch.
Yeah, right? It's in Le Jardin de Marie. If you have to pardon my French accent.
Marie's Jardin. Marie's Garden.
That's right. In Le Chateau.
Yeah.
And it's on, I think it's Friday the 10th of May. But check it out if you're in the region with Toby and Gerda Dobler, who are the proprietors of Le Jardin, because they're the ones who are hosting it.
There was a film recently that I saw in the last couple of years called Bloodlines.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a sort of, I can't really tell if it was a mockumentary or a documentary, or whether it was actually...
It's Bloodline singular, I think, isn't it? Because I think I've seen
Bloodline, the movie, or something.
Yeah. It talks about the Priory of Zion.
Yeah, and they go to the Priory of Zion and dig up some bones and some...
Yeah, well, it's... Because Ben Hammett features in that, the Tomb Man. But actually, it turns out that a lot of his work is apparently not reliable. Mm-hmm. I can't really say much more than that, because you start getting all these different stories about, you know, what's the truth and what's...
So where can people research this for themselves? Because, I mean, it is really a very, very interesting subject.
Where can people... research. I mean, I can't remember who said it. I'm sure a lot of people have said it, but basically Google is your friend. In other words, use search engines on the internet. I mean, I must admit, I use Google quite freely. I know the powers that were, or the powers that be, or what you want to call them.
Yeah,
they say that, oh, you know, that allows them to, you know, watch you and see what you're looking at, etc. To me, I don't give a stuff. I don't care. But if you go in and put in some searches, and what I've often found is that if you put in, you know, maybe a couple of terms that don't appear to be connected, but you just say, well, what if, you know, what if there was a connection between this and that?
Yeah.
It can throw up some surprising results.
Yeah.
But if I can maybe, that's an interesting point about research, because when I gave the talk at the Francis Bacon Society in December, I started to ask myself the question about what I meant by research, because a lot of it, if you think about it, especially when you're talking about Bacon and, you know, a lot of the information that was coming out in those times, you know, were the Shakespeare plays used as a kind of coding mechanism for secret information to be put out to the masses? And of course the Cathars, because of the threat of the Catholic Church, they had to do an awful lot of stuff in secrecy as well. So lo and behold, you're not going to find a lot of documented information that's going to be reliable. In fact, a lot of what we've had about the Cathars has been from the Inquisition records. Although more recently there has been information that's come through a guy called Arthur Gurdham. That's spelled G-U-I-R-D-H-A-M. And he was a psychoanalyst based in Bath in England.
I used to live near there.
Yeah, well, and you haven't come across him. Well, he had a patient, and she was having these nightmare visions and past life recall, and he was very, very sceptical. But again, to cut a very long story short, it turned out, apparently, that there was a pocket of reincarnated Cathars in the Bath and Bristol area of England in the 1970s. And he's written a number of books. So again, if people want to research the Cathars from that perspective, there's a book called The Great Heresy, the Keep in the Castle, I think it's called, or The Castle in the... The Lake in the Castle, that's what it's called. But there's a number, so Arthur Gurdham, again, you can put that in as a search term. And so, yeah, going back to the research question, I started to look at what I meant by research and how I researched. And although we're on radio and I can't actually show the slides, I actually put some slides together for the Francis Bacon Society meeting just to make it explicit, you know, how I looked at things. Because it's not just about reading books and documents. In fact, one of the kind of loops I kind of created was, okay, you start off with information, which is fine, information, you know, stuff that you start looking at. But then you've got to start looking at, okay, imagination. You know, start to try and think what it was like with these groups working in secrecy. And if you said the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time, your head chopped off.
Somebody's dead. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so trying to envisage what it would have been like in that kind of context, which is quite difficult, you know, even though it's only like 400 years ago, in a completely different world to the one we have today. And then you've also got these aspects of, intuition, you know, just that, which is kind of tied in with clairsentience and, you know, from a sort of psychic point of view, you just start to have these sort of feelings about things, and then inspiration, you know, and that then feeds you back into information. So there's a kind of loop there. But what I found interesting there was that information was the only aspect of that loop that was predominantly kind of left-brained. Yeah, and all the rest were more kind of like right-brained, and then, but you're checking it back at information level. And that seems to mirror, you know, a lot of scientific kind of discovery that we've had over the last Einstein exactly
he's the man visions. And he's all about imagination. He's, you know, there's very little, I mean, he starts off with his factual empirical research, but then he goes off traveling in his mind. And that's what geniuses do.
That's right. Yeah. Kerkele was it with the benzene ring and the Ouroboros and all this sort of stuff. So anyway, so that was quite interesting. That I had another kind of loop, if I can just remember. It was like, this idea of interconnectedness. Now, at an information level, obviously the internet is a great tool. And as I said, you know, in terms of researching, we've got a tremendously powerful tool at our disposal there. in terms of searching, you know, accessing information. Often the difficulty is keeping it kind of reined in, you know, and there's a bit of a kind of trick there in terms of, you know, because otherwise you can just go all over the place. Sometimes it's nice to kind of take detours, but at the end of the day, I think you've got to have a kind of question that's kind of at least guiding
you.
Stay
focused.
Yes, exactly. But also you've got on the human side, you've got that kind of, you know, the fact that we are all actually interconnected. So we're, you know, we're discussing earlier about the different networks that we're involved in. And these are all important and they're major sources of information too. But again, you know, it's interesting, it's, you know, like the Khazars, there was a lot of talk about us rediscovering the Khazars. And when I thought about it, I thought, well, there's a certain truth to that, but I think it's not just about that. I think it's like, if you can imagine, the Khazars have been like calling out to us through that kind of consciousness veil. And those that are sensitive are actually picking up on these messages and tuning in. And I think that's what's happening more and more now. So that although the Catholic Inquisition, you know, burnt the people, burnt the records, they never obliterated the consciousness.
Yes.
And that's what's coming back big time now. And isn't it interesting what's happening with the Catholic Church now?
Exactly. So yeah. let's just explore this little pocket right now, because that's kind of right on my street. The whole idea of the collective consciousness, and of course the Inquisition was not about killing people; it was about killing the story about who we are, where we're from, who's up there, who's down there, who's in charge. All of those little pieces of the big puzzle. Because those are the questions that we really want to know the answer to. But that the Catholic Church has been consistently and systematically destroying all sources of other information than their own story.
Well, they've attempted to do that.
That's the attempt. Yeah. And they did, and they've done it with the American Indians.
With the Mayans. Yeah.
They've done it with the Jews. They've done it with the, because the Holocaust was really the second Inquisition, to remove the story, the Judeo-Christian story even. Which is slightly different from the
I can't really comment on that one, but I do know that certainly look at the Mayans, actually I think a lot of information was kept back, and a big question is, you know, what the hell is in the Vatican secret archives, for example?
Oh, wouldn't we love to know? I'd really love to know.
Yeah, but I think that stuff's going to come out. I mean, I just read the other day about the Los Angeles, you know, the priests and the paedophile scandal, the records, 30,000 pages of records are supposed to be being released. A judge has ordered them.
Wow.
And they're scurrying about redacting documents and all.
They're going to have to use up an awful lot of magic marker ink.
Well, I know. But I mean, the thing is, I think we're reaching stage, Jeremy, that the truth vibration, as David Icke called it way back.
Yeah.
You know, is kicking in, you know, so strongly now that there's no hiding place for this stuff. So we've got the Pope kind of suddenly resigning, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
We've got the top guy in Scotland, the Catholic Church, he's just resigned yesterday.
Is he? All right, that's a new one. Yeah,
interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
And
just at the same time, everybody's coming out and saying, "Whoa, no, 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 yeah, paedophile, yeah, right." Yeah,
exactly.
Interesting. It's very interesting that that's all. It's all coming out now, and I believe not much of a coincidence, really.
No,
to be honest, I'm not surprised. You know, but we could see this coming. We've seen this whole issue brewing over the last couple of years, and there have been more and more people who are gaining strength and their own courage to blow their own whistle.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'd say thank God for all the whistleblowers.
Well, that's right. And, you know, they've had such a hard time because the powers have managed to keep a lid on things to a certain extent, but it's like a pressure cooker. You know, you can only keep it on so long, and then eventually, and I think we're reaching that stage where the lid is just blowing off now. And it's happening in all areas. So I think we're going to see more and more of these kind of scandals and whatever, you know, just being exposed, because that's the only way that they're going to be dealt with, and we do evolve as a caring, compassionate society. Mm. You know, it's interesting that a lot of this stuff was done in the name of supposed goodness, and it's been horrendous.
It's been the complete antithesis of what they say. So,
but that's like so much that's going on in the world, in politics and in government and corporations.
If you see it on TV, it's going to be a lie.
Yeah,
in general, and you know, certainly, I've seen this lovely little thing. You know, if you see food that's advertised on TV, don't eat it, because if you need to be sold it, it's no good for you.
Yeah.
So,
speaking of food, I mean, you know, we've had the latest scandal with
eat a horse.
Beef, exactly, you know, the horse meat. Mm. Yeah, and if it wasn't so serious, you'd really have to laugh.
Mm.
First of all, the Food Standards Agency in the UK were not the ones who spotted the problem in the first place. It was the agency in Ireland, because one of the suppliers that was involved was actually based in Ireland, so good luck to them that they actually identified it. So the FSA in this country did nothing, apparently, at the time. Once they understood there was a problem, they started doing all these checks, you know, which is fine. And then in the news the other day, they're saying, oh, we've got the problem contained. And you think, well, hold on a minute. How could they suddenly, within a month, say that the problem is contained when you've got all this stuff that's floating about Europe?
I'll tell you why it's contained. It's all in boxes.
Yeah.
It's all in little packets that are in freezers all over the place with lasagna on the
front. Exactly. Yeah. You know, and the other...
spaghetti bolognese.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, discussed before, which I feel really, really strongly about, is aspartame in products.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and...
That's one of my favourites. Sweet as sugar and twice as deadly.
Yeah, and, you know, sucralose seems to be just about as bad, from what I can gather. And yet the FSA, you know, are quite happy to say, oh, yes, you know, that... So you wonder, you know, what's going on behind the scenes with these bodies, you know, because apparently aspartame is now in 6,000 products. And I would say to anybody out there who are drinking diet drinks, I won't name proprietary brands, but I think
anything
you know
with diet in front of it.
Anything within diet. And even soft drinks that maybe don't have diet but still contain aspartame.
I think all the Fanta range contain, no matter
just
whether
mentioned
it's free.
A brand there. Never mind.
Scrum.
Yeah.
Scrum. Sue me. Because if they sue me to say, you know, this stuff is dangerous, and, you know, they're going to have to prove it.
Yeah.
They're not. So
from, you know, from the FSA point of view, we have this problem with the horse meat. You know, as I say, we've got this other problem, as I see it, with them actually allowing this lethal stuff to be released into the food chain. And you then have to question, well, one, can you trust any labels of foodstuffs that are on the shelves?
To read the labels, that's another thing, if the labels are actually reflecting what's inside.
Exactly. And also, can we trust the likes of the FSA to be a truly independent body who's there to protect consumers? I think the answer to that is very rapidly becoming no.
Not very much.
Unless they can prove otherwise, because, you know, they have big offices, I'm sure they've got, you know, highly paid staff. Mm. But what do they actually do if they're not protecting the public? So if there's anybody there from the FSA listening in and want to challenge me on that, I'd be happy to listen.
1-775-657-5978. If you're from the British Food Standards Agency, come and defend yourself.
Well, it was interesting that Max Kaiser the other day, Max is somebody I follow quite a bit on the internet.
We love Max,
And he was talking about, because we've actually got two FSAs in Britain.
Have we?
We've got the Food Standards Agency and we've got the Financial Services Authority.
All right, yeah.
And of course, you know, one's, I was going to say, one's as bad as the other, one's as good as the other.
Yeah, they're both as corrupt as each other, yeah.
Oh, how could you say a word like that, John?
I'm radical. This is Revolution Radio. We can say that these institutions are corrupt because they are.
Interesting. I think I said in the last show I'd been invited to a book festival in Wigton last year to speak in or be involved in a panel on Inside the Minds of the Bankers, I think, to speak on that. And there's a guy on the panel who used to work for Barclays Bank, and his father was ex-deputy chairman. And we're sitting there, and of course I was taking quite a kind of radical view, you know, basically saying, well, these guys are psychopaths.
Yeah.
In fact, even the mainstream media are saying this now, like the Sunday Times, I believe, has been saying the number of psychopaths and sociopaths we have in corporate boardrooms and in the banks. Well, surprise, surprise, we've kind of known about that for a while.
Yeah.
But if you've got these corporations actually there to reward psychopathic behavior, guess what? That's what you're going to get. So, of course, I was making these statements at the book festival, and he said, oh, no, you know, it's just these guys are, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what about the LIBOR rate rigging? You know, cause, that's right, because I'd made a comment about the criminal global financial system.
Yeah.
Oh, you can't say it's criminal. I said, yes, I can. He said, well, no, nobody's actually been brought to prosecution.
Not
I said,
yet.
I said, not yet. And he said, well, what about LIBOR rate rigging? He said, oh, well, more or less what he said was, because everybody was doing it, it wasn't criminal, it was cheating.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the culture of these guys.
That's right.
You know, it's like they feel they're above the law.
They've blurred the line between right and wrong.
And there's another issue there about the City of London and the fact that that's a city-state out with the UK. So maybe they are above the UK law because they're under different laws.
Mm.
I think that's something that's got to be looked at very carefully, because you've then got the three-city-state connection between City of London, Vatican and Washington, D.C., so you've got London is the financial one, Vatican's the religious one, Washington D.C. is the military one. So you've got that kind of triangle of whatever you want to call
control,
it.
Control, global control mechanism,
Which then makes you wonder, in terms of the Scottish independence question, where that's going
to
fit in.
I think, you know, to just dip into that one, as far as I'm concerned, it's out of the frying pan into the fire. If the Scots go independent, then it means that the Scots then join Euro, which is a super state that was designed by Adolf Hitler in the first place.
Exactly.
Yeah. Welcome to Mein Kampf.
Yeah. So what's the point of being independent from England if we're still in the EU?
That's right.
This corrupt state.
That's right. It's even worse in the EU than it is in England. So, it wouldn't be frying pan and fire. But obviously, a lot of people in Scotland, you know, have a long-term resentment towards Britain for the being the oppressors and all that stuff. But again, the English people had the Roman Empire behind them in the old days, before Henry VIII. Long story.
Yeah, so, but there are big questions to ask, but, you know, central banks as well. Because I think, as I said before, I was a manifesto writer for the Bad Bankers Bonuses Party in Scotland, and I stood in the Scottish elections in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I said was, we would like the Scottish government to print money itself at no interest without going to a central bank like we have with the Bank of England.
Yeah.
You know. Now, is anybody asking that kind of question? You know, where's this money going to be coming from? Yeah, well, it's all like it's in here anyway.
Mm.
But why should we be paying the Rothschilds and whoever?
Why should we be paying people interest on money that is in thin air when we can create our own thin air?
Exactly.
We've got lovely thin air. It's actually very thick, soft air here.
We've got clean thin air.
Clean and thick and soft and yummy and lovely air. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I love living here.
Yeah. And so, going back to the three books, because, you know, to kind of weave the story.
Tie them together,
Well, what I did, and I'll use the kind of presentation of Francis Bacon Society as a kind of backdrop to this. Looking at Conan Doyle and Bacon initially, what linked those two together? Well, it was, truth and justice was a big thing for them. But there's also this subtle aspect of love and this idea of divine love and love in action. You know, which is something that's used certainly around Findhorn. Mm. You know, people kind of understand it.
Yeah.
It's just the way of being. It's the way, you know, it should be a natural way. Love is
the natural state of being of the human,
And when I looked at Cathars, and I said we had a brilliant trip out there last year, and went to the Cathar Caves, made a lot of good connections, and I said we're doing the book launch in Rennes Le Château in May. When I looked at that, when I kind of added the Cathars into that kind of equation and looked at the overall story, it was quite simple. It was, you know, because the Cathars, one of their prime documents, supposedly was a book called The Book of Love. So love was very dear to their hearts as well. So the overall kind of conclusion of looking at three, it was choose love, not fear. And that's got to be the message for now.
That's the message of the centre, isn't it?
Exactly. And so it's almost like a holograph. You know, I've happened to take it from those three perspectives, but you could take it from a whole number of perspectives and arrive at the same conclusion.
Mm.
Unless you're one of the ones who are on the 4% archontic, is it? And psychopathic, sociopathic part of the
4%
spectrum. That's what they reckon.
Wow, that's quite a lot.
It is.
Yeah. that's a sobering amount. Yeah, you know, you'd have felt, you know, because that, like they're talking about.
Well, if you remember, just to sort of revisit that from last time, when I was down south last year, I went to Brian Geddes's conference, Strike a Chord in Dunstable.
Mm-hmm.
Brian was there, and Ian R. Crane was there. You know, some really good speakers.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have to get Crane on the show as well.
Yeah, yeah. There was Thomas Sheridan, the Irish Thomas Sheridan, yes. who's
a psychopath guy.
Yeah.
He's not a psychopath. He talks about psychopaths.
Yeah, he used to be a graphics designer with Goldman Sachs and Wall Street in New York. But not a banker himself, but he knew the banking culture.
Yeah, he was in there.
So he did a lot of work in psychopaths, and he reckoned, he came up with a 4% number. And then when I went to see David Icke in October last year at Wembley,
mm-hmm.
Apart from talking about the Cathars and Montsegur and 1244, and then he talked about the Archons. I don't really want to go into that again this time, because I did discuss it last time.
Yeah, we've spoken about the Archons.
Interesting subject, a very, very interesting subject. Who they are and how they affect us.
Yeah, other dimensional entities, put it that way. But Archon, if you want to check it out. But when I went to see David Icke, and he was talking about the Archons, and he reckoned that 4% of the population were either Archons, who were shapeshifters into like human...
Mm-hmm.
Looking like humans, or they were actually influencing humans to be like psychopaths. And I thought, well, 4%, 4%, is there a connection here? And when I looked into it, I came across a wonderful YouTube video of an interview that was made, I think it was last April, May, mm-hmm. 2012. And Thomas Sheridan was speaking from the psychopathic perspective, and there's an American guy, John Lash, who's talking from the Archons, and they were talking about precisely this thing.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend to listeners, to if you're interested in this area,
what's the search terms for that?
So, well, John Lamb, L-A-M-B,
mm-hmm.
and then L-A-S-H,
mm-hmm.
and then Thomas Sheridan, S-H-E-R-I-D-A-N, and if you just put in Archon, A-R-C-H-O-N, you'll get that YouTube video. Well, do the search actually in YouTube. That's what I'd recommend.
Yeah, I'm just gonna share it on Sheridan. Yes. So there we go. So I'll just put that search term into Google and into YouTube so that people can pick that up. So. They were bringing all these things together. So,
yeah, there you go.
That one, the one at the top, though.
No, I think it's the second one down.
Truth in its many facets. Thomas Sheridan. That's the one handling the psychopath. Okay, so
or the two just further down. You've got part one, and part two.
All right. That there it is.
Yeah.
So let me get service of self-taking as well. Right. So I'll just pop that into the chat room now. There's the video. I would find that incredibly interesting, and I'm going to watch that later.
Yeah, I mean it is on YouTube, but it is a you know voice interview, but it's very very worthwhile listening to. And in fact, John Lash's website's
very interesting guy. Interesting guy.
Yeah. So there's a lot of these things that are, you know, again we're connecting the dots in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
But what I did when I listened to Thomas Sheridan and then looked at the Archon bit, I came up with kind of like four levels that seem to be operating in society. And so you've got the psychopaths and you've got, you know, 4%, but they're in control of so many, you know, corporations.
Because they're the treasurer and the secretary of all the corporations.
Yeah. And, but then you've got the proto-psychopaths. Mm. You know, they're the ones who are not clinically wired up to be psychopathic in their behavior, but they're copying these guys because they see that as a way to be, quote, be successful or getting ahead, etc. Which kind of makes you wonder about things like NLP, you know, modeling behavior and stuff. Is that in some ways just modeling people to become psychopathic in their behavior? Perhaps. So certainly something to watch out for.
Yeah. I was talking about NLP the other night.
Yeah, and then the other level, third level, would be what's known as the useful idiots, and that's a phrase that came out of Leninist Russia, I think. People who are just happy to go at their jobs, not even think of the big picture, do a job, take their money, thank you very much, and basically just, you know.
Yeah, and that even goes to people who, for instance, are internet speakers or something like that, who are... they're pushing the agenda that the powers that be want in an unconscious way because they're hooking onto different things that they can believe in because they sound nice.
Yes. And then you've got what I call the good guys. You know, they're the ones who are people with integrity, and I think that's the majority of the people on this planet, to be honest.
Mm.
But they tend to be a bit fragmented because they're transparent in the way they work. They operate with integrity. Truth is important to them. And of course, if you've got psychopaths operating in secret societies, quite happy to lie and deceive. And, you know, we see it all the time in governments. I mean, it's becoming more and more farcical.
Yeah.
You know, what they want is to try and believe is truth. Yeah, it's just so much bollocks, basically. Bollocks is a technical term, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, you can say bollocks on American radio.
So, so the trick is, if you've got these four levels, psychopaths, proto-psychopaths, useful idiots, and the good guys, it's how do we invert that so it will get the good guys in charge? And maybe part of that is this kind of planetary vibrational thing that's going on, that somehow, you know, these because they're lower vibrational entities, these psychopaths, and, you know, so as the vibration's rising, then perhaps they're not going to be able to operate as they have in the past. I think that's been clearly demonstrated
I think
with the stuff that's coming out, even into the mainstream.
I think that the whole idea about trying to keep secrets down when the truth is just so obviously starting to really blossom out and become really part of the problem that we've had in the past is that everything that we've been taught and that we've believed is actually an inversion of the truth.
Yeah,
you know, and it sounds like a really crazy idea. You know, everything you watch on TV is a lie. You know, you could make that statement. Yeah, but I mean, in general, you know, anything certainly to do with science is limited, because we know that there are vehicles that are flying around in our atmosphere that don't use jets, that don't use oil. They work on a completely different technology that defies the laws of physics as we've been taught.
Yes.
So that's the first thing, you know, I call that black science because it's like black.
And if you look at the other side of that, free energy and the Tesla technology and such like, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, although I'm not a scientist, that there is a lot of truth in there. And one of the things that needs to be done as soon as possible is to unsuppress all that free technology.
This is where things get complicated, because it's the black operations, the black budget operations that have that technology already, and they're not releasing it because they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that what their problem is the fact that they want. Oh, there's the end of the show. Wow, that was quick. Dave Patrick, quickly with your website.
I don't really have a website at the moment, but if I can just mention my new radio show.
New radio show on?
On abcradio.co.uk, Friday night, 7 till 9 PM GMT. And it's blues rock music for the first, well, in fact, no, I've combined it. Blues rock music and interviews with guest speakers, some of whom will be performing music live in studio, some will be just chatting about interesting subjects like we're doing tonight.
We're going to be up in a second. Thank you very much for listening to Journeys. see you again later on today on Wall Street on the Radio with Andrew Bartlett. Good night, everybody.